Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. T. Colin Campbell, who will speak on Nutrition, Forgotten, Malign Science. T. Colin Campbell is an American biochemist who specializes in the effect of nutrition on long-term health. He is the Jacob Gould Sherman Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University. Dr. Campbell has become known for his advocacy of a low-fat, whole foods, plant-based diet. He is the author of over 300 research papers on the subject and two books, Whole in 2013 and The China Study in 2005, co-authored with his son, which became one of America's best-selling books on nutrition. He is featured in the 2011 documentary, Forks Over Knives. Dr. Campbell is one of the lead scientists in the 1980s of the China-Oxford-Cornell study on diet and disease, set up in 1983 by Cornell University, the University of Oxford, and the Chinese Academy of Preventive Medicine to explore the relationship between nutrition and cancer, heart, and metabolic diseases. This study was described by the New York Times as the Grand Prix of Epidemiology. He is known in particular for research derived in part from the China Project that appears to link the consumption of animal protein with the development of cancer and heart disease. He argues that casein, a protein found in milk from mammals, is the most significant carcinogen we consume. Dr. Campbell and his son Nelson have teamed up to on a new feature-length documentary, Plant Pure Nation. It'll be shown tonight, but I understand that showing is already sold out, but it will be in the box office in the next few weeks. So, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you, Bill. Dr. Grant, I should say. Maybe I just wanted to hear this, but I thought when you said, you announced my title, the Nutrition, the Forgotten, Forlorn Science. Did you say forlorn? It's a good word. I accept it if that was the case. I've been at this game for a long time. I formally got involved in research on diet and cancer. It'll be 59 years ago this August. So I've been around a little while. And as time has passed, I've sort of learned some things along the way, and some of my colleagues have too, that what I now have come to know, think I know at least, based on science, what I've come to know is almost the antithesis, almost exactly the opposite of what I originally thought. I came from a dairy farm, milking cows. And so I was into the good old American diet, high in protein, high in fat, high in whatever. And of course, now we're talking about something very different. So what I also have arrived at a point, too, when I guess I can say I'm excited about this field. I'm a little frustrated at times because of the kickback that we get at times. And so I want to argue that we really don't understand very well the science. And I'm talking about people both on the side of the equation that I represent as well as the side of the equation that others do. So I want to talk a little about just questioning the scientific foundation for several sort of entities or industries we have. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. It represents fairly sophisticated science at times, a little bit technical, but I'm going to try to make it as best I can. Get warmed up here. Okay, so anyhow, that's my title, of course. Let me start off with this particular display here. This published in 2009 by an agency, Office of Economic and Community Development, associated with the United Nations, shows that there, as far as health care costs are concerned, since about, 1970 or so, that the United States, the top line, we've been outpacing all other countries like us, sort of the Western industrialized countries. So we are spending a lot of money in this country for health care, as all of you really know well. But we're so far ahead of the others, we're sort of just running away with the story. So I'm going to argue that basically that what is missing in this thing as far as our troubles are concerned, both cost of health care, environmental issues, personal health, and other sorts of things, what is missing is our understanding of nutrition. Nutrition, as I say, is forgotten. If it was ever known, it's certainly not known very well. And in fact, it's a premier biomedical science that we need to know. In the present day contemporary nutrition, obviously we're, as a public, we're very confused about what this really means. There's little or no nutrition taught in medical schools. There's not a medical school in the United States that really takes this subject seriously. Most doctors have had no training in nutrition, either during their formal medical school training or in their subsequent residency programs. That's changing a little bit. Some schools are getting involved and taking it up, but it's basically been forgotten. And the third thing is that nutrition research funding by the National Institutes of Health, which is the key research funding agency that we all live by, and the largest, most influential research funding agency in the world, actually, in this area. There's 28 institutes, National Institutes of Health, essentially. There's the Cancer Institute, the Heart Institute, and so forth and so on. There's not one called the Institute of Nutrition. So we don't train our doctors in nutrition, and we don't have funding hardly at all to support the kind of research that we need to do. So it's not surprising the public's confused. Basically, we're hearing all kinds of information. You know the story. I don't need to remind you of that. And I want to start off with just some examples of, you know, the kind of trouble we get into. It's particularly nutrition not understood very well as far as cancer is concerned, either in terms of what causes cancer, as well as in terms of how do we treat cancer once it's been diagnosed. Now, to illustrate my point here, there's been a long time sort of theory of cancer development that most of us in cancer research have lived with that I question. Basically, it's the so-called mutation theory of cancer. This is a timeline of how cancer evolves and develops. We have a starting point, and then we progress through the years, and the cancer will begin, of course, finally to grow into a tumor. And at time, this timeline may be over many years. There's a beginning point. And the beginning point, usually we tend to agree with this, the beginning point has to do with a normal cell being mutated. So it's a mutation. Mutation converts a normal cell to a cancer cell that kind of gets the ball rolling, in a sense. We call that first stage initiation. I call it the start of mutation. This is fair enough. Most of us tend to agree with this kind of idea that cancer is a genetic disease in that sense. It starts with an altered gene. Second stage is promotion. And the argument that has been used, whether it's expressed or not is beside the point, is basically assumed by virtually everyone, really not questioned for the most part by most. That is, cancer progresses by sort of experiencing a subsequent series of mutations. So cancer starts with the first mutation, and then as we go through the years, we keep suffering additional mutations wherever they may come from, chemicals in the food, water, whatever, maybe sunlight, whatever. And so it's a sequence of mutations piled one on top of the other that progresses us forward. That's the idea. And then finally, we get diagnosed. That third stage is generally called progression. It has to do with cancer metastasizes and it gets really mischievous. And so that's the sort of fundamental thing I want you to keep in mind a little bit as I discuss this. This idea of cancer being caused by a series of mutations now is being argued as being a random series of mutations. We don't know where they come from. That was a report just recently in Science. It was touted on CNN. It was on PBS. It was discussed widely. It was discussed in the New York Times. And I think the public didn't really understand this because the argument was, look, if there's a series of mutations and we don't know where they come from, you know, then we lose control. They lose control. And one thing you need to know about mutations is that mutations are not reversible. If you have a cell that's been mutated, it's going to be fixed there for the rest of your life. That's really what a mutation is. So, and if you have a series of mutations, the cancer becomes ever more reversible. I mean, ever more fixed, in a sense, can't be reversed. And since it can't be reversed, then the theory has been, over the last 40, 50 years, is that the only way we can treat this during disease or intercept it is to go in there and find out where those cancer cells are and treat them with a chemical, especially after you get diagnosed with cancer. So we set up a system using chemicals to destroy those cancer cells. Chemotherapy, targeted radiation therapy. That's the basis for the entire cancer industry. I'm arguing that's wrong. We may see a benefit, some benefits here and there, but basically it's fundamentally wrong. So in any case, this became a big issue. The public may or may not have heard of this, but recently it was just reinforced, the whole idea. Cancer is a series of mutations. So the question is, it's irreversible. So as I say, if we make that assumption that it's irreversible, then we have to go find ways to kill those cells. And we have this concept called targeted drug therapy these days, trying to find yet another chemical that can go in and identify those cells and kill them. What else? There's nothing else because you can't reverse them. And, of course, we use chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. Nutrition is left out of the equation. That's my point. And I'll show you some evidence here that that's really not correct. I got involved in this business, as I say, many, many years ago when I was working in the Philippines, and we were attempting to make sure some poor children got enough protein. And we discovered or got the impression that the children consuming the most protein, not very many, were more susceptible to getting cancer. I mean, it was a shock for me because I thought that we went there to make sure they got enough protein, when in fact, the few who got the most protein, it appeared totally anecdotal, nothing published, just an impression. And then this report came out in India with experimental animals, where they also thought that the amount of protein in the diet might relate to the causation of cancer, in this case, the same kind of cancer as in the children, liver cancer. They thought if they gave animals more protein, it would tend to inhibit the development of the cancer. So they did this little study here, as you can see, published in 1968. They gave one group of animals the 20% protein. That's the usual level. That's the recommended level. The other they gave 5%. With the thought in mind that the animals getting 20% protein would have less cancer. All these animals had been exposed to a carcinogen, so they had the first mutation. So they had the first mutation, they were programmed to get the cancer. The ones fed the higher levels of protein, they were going to argue less cancer. It turned out to be exactly the opposite. The researchers did not believe that, and they went on to do some other things to try to disprove it. And in fact, I didn't have the opportunity until 25 years later, when I was invited to India, to point out to them that I had taken a different path on this, that the high-protein diet was, in fact, enhancing the development of cancer, not essentially preventing it. So it meant more protein, more cancer. Kind of a ridiculous idea, at least for me, coming from the dairy farm, as I say, when we thought that high-protein diets were a good deal. So then we embarked on a study that lasted for 27 years, funded by the National Institutes of Health, specifically by the National Cancer Institute. And we did a lot of research over the years trying to sort this out. Particularly wanted to know, is this really true, that protein can increase cancer, number one? And number two, if it's really true, difficult to comprehend, but if it's really true, what's the mechanism? And that was the basis for our getting involved in doing this kind of research. And I'm just going to show you a couple of things that come back to my point about nutrition being related to cancer and not generally acknowledged. Here's a little study here showing, for example, we first have a chemical mutation. Subsequently, we feed different levels of protein, just like the Indian workers did, essentially. So we go start our initiation, do the protein thing. And when we feed 20% protein in the first 12 weeks, those cancers are growing rather well because they're exposed to the mutation, things that go in. We get then 5% protein, the cancers don't grow. Pretty remarkable. But it was consistent with what I thought I saw in the children, and it was consistent as well with what the Indian workers had done but yet disbelieved. So the higher protein, higher cancer. So we got something going here. Then we did this. We did a lot of different kinds of research, but I'm just going to show you a couple of the more notable observations that are kind of interesting. We fed animals the 20% protein in the first 3 weeks. Cancers are growing. Fed them 5%, turned it off, turned it on, turned it off. This was pretty remarkable because here we were actually controlling the development of cancer by a nutrient, of all things, protein. Protein turning it on. You drop the level, turns it off. So what's going on here? This really kicked off much of my career, in fact, and going down this pathway of trying to understand this. The protein of all things that we were using is the main protein of cow's milk. I'll remind you again, I came from a dairy farm. Took me about 2 years to digest this idea, no pun intended. But the idea of protein actually causing cancer, that was a little bit beyond the pale. Then we did it just sort of finish this little idea up here. We did the same thing with some other combinations. We took, for example, different levels of fat having to do with pancreatic cancer in this case, instead of liver cancer is what we did before. So we adjusted fat levels. And this is what we got. We could turn it on and turn it off in effect with the amount of dietary fat. Again, same conclusion. Nutrition could be used to turn on and turn off cancer. So nutrition controls cancer growth. Okay, so we got this idea of cancer being turned on and turned off. In this case, it's not over time. It's being essentially turned on and turned off as we change from one kind of diet to another kind of diet insofar as fat intake is concerned. So I hope this is not too confusing, but I just wanted to, in general, say, no, then we use corn oil. That's beside the point. Yeah, it doesn't, yeah, it's just used in fat. What I want to do here is not to focus on that kind of detail, just turn with the idea of just turning things on and off by nutrient intake. So let's go back to this thing here again. As I said, cancer, because it's a series of mutations, is considered to be irreversible. It's a foundation for the entire cancer industry. It's reversible. It's not irreversible, it's reversible. And this was first published in the early 1980s. It's been published extensively. And I have to tell you, the cancer industry simply don't want to acknowledge this. They don't want to go there to even admit the idea that nutrition can have something to do with cancer, but it's reversible. So I question, what is the cancer industry? What are they surviving on? Why are they doing what they're doing? And so we're ignoring this really essential, really important point of view having to do with nutrition being used either to prevent cancer and or being used, I'm going to argue, in actually treating cancer once it exists. So that's one example. Here's another sort of example of how I want to challenge what we tend to think we know. And it has to do with nutrition. First off, isolated nutrients, usually found in the form of nutrient supplements, really don't work like we thought they did. I was involved early on testifying on behalf of the government, in this case, regarding the claims made by industry in those days, and I've watched closely as things have unfolded. There's lots of studies basically show it's largely a waste of time, except for maybe a couple of instances. Vitamin B12 in this particular case is significant, possibly vitamin D in some ways. But in any case, in general, isolated nutrients is not, that's pharmacology. I don't consider that nutrition. It's like drug therapy, just using nutrients. It's not really nutrition. So we can probably, I'd like to say we can kind of set that aside, even though in the short term we might look like we see some things interesting. So isolated nutrients is not, that's not nutrition. They work together. It's not, that really isn't it. Also, the effect of nutrition on whatever it's going to do doesn't function through a single mechanism. In other words, if we consume a nutrient, theory, then it has some effect, and we like to look, what is the mechanism? Which enzyme is involved here? Which hormone? Which this? Which that? That's the basis for the drug industry, that kind of thinking. So in reality, I'm going to suggest nutrition is not based on the effects of individual nutrients. For example, going back to this model here again, when I said before, you know, we got interested first to reproduce if we could, the results the Indian workers had done, for one thing. And the second thing I wanted to know, how does it work? So let's look in these different phases. In the first stage, we just, based on the knowledge we had at that time, and that was like 35, 40 years ago, we started looking for the mechanism by which this high-protein diet increases cancer. And you can see here, I've got a bunch of things listed here. Each one of these usually requiring 3 or 4 years worth of work on the part of a postdoctoral student or a doctoral student. And basically what we learned is that high protein diets increase the entry of the carcinogen into the cell. That's the thing that starts the first mutation. So we found that the high protein diet increases the rate at which it goes into the cell. Then when it gets into the cell, it gets metabolized by an enzyme. And so we looked at the effect of protein on the enzyme system. And there again, the higher protein diet increased the activity of the enzyme, that turned around and took the carcinogen and turned it into a product that could cause a mutation. So the high-protein diet was doing that. And we said, wow, we're on the right track here. We're finding how this thing works. High-protein diet increases the amount of carcinogen you get in the cell. And when it gets in the cell, it turns around and activates it faster. So we get more mutations, essentially, and many different things. And then we turned our attention to the second stage. The second stage has to do with promotion. And once again, we look for maybe the explanatory mechanism. Higher protein diet increases the rate at which these cells divide, as these cells start to divide. The higher protein diet increases the hormone that causes cancer to grow. It decreases the body's natural ability to actually get rid of those cells. Our body kills those cancer cells. It's beautiful, and we just let it happen. So our body has this capability of killing these early cancer cells and keeping things under control. The higher protein diet actually compromises that. It compromises our repair structure, our repair mechanism, if you will. And it does some other things. So what came out of this, we couldn't decide that there was a single mechanism. It's a whole bunch of mechanisms all working together. And it turns out that is the way nutrition works in all cases. Nutrition works, if you go by nutrient, there's a whole lot of things happening simultaneously. It's like a tsunami of things happening. And then you put all the nutrients together in the form of food. Then you can just imagine you're going to see really pretty dramatic effects if the food being consumed is correct. So summarize quickly on this example. Isolated chemicals, whether they're nutrients or whether they're drugs. This is the idea of drug therapy, by the way. We like to use one drug at a time to do whatever it is we want to have done. So isolated chemicals, let's say chemicals, whether nutrients or drugs, don't work quite that way, not the way in terms of health, and they don't work by focused on one single mechanism. It's ineffective in terms of controlling and treating cancer, at least. So I'm going to ask this question. I would suggest that our entire thesis and our understanding or assumptions of using drugs to advance health is wrong. It's founded on very bad science. It doesn't really make sense. Doing one thing at a time. And that's really what accounts for the fact that drugs have side effects. I mean, all drugs have side effects. On top of that, usually are foreign compounds. The body has to try to detoxify them, get rid of them. So the whole thesis for taking the approach of going the pharmaceutical route, I question. This leads us to an idea of something different. Well, what if you just consume all these chemicals, not as individual chemicals? What if you just consume them as food? You know, the way we evolved, I would suggest. You're just using food. And when we use that, then we have to decide what kind of foods. Well, let me jump way ahead here. You know probably what I'm going to say. It's whole plant-based foods. They have the right kinds and the right amounts of nutrient, you know, all packaged together nicely. And when you consume the food, the body has a way of just using all this stuff, sorting out these complexities, and doing it in such a way to create health. That's really what happens. And at the same time, of course, preventing disease. So a whole food plant-based diet is where it's at. It does all the things that we would like to have done. So what I'm doing is I'm really questioning, without having the time to defend the proposition all that much, I'm questioning the way we think about nutrition. I don't like to think about nutrition in terms of individual nutrients. It's really the whole food. That's where we get the really big effects from. Here's another question concerning the role of genes. You know the story. We hear from time to time that genes are maybe more involved in causing such and such a disease instead of, let's say, nutrition. And the question I'm raising here, are genes the main determinants of health and disease outcomes? Everything starts with genes, yes. Whatever it is, everything biological starts with a gene and then goes through a series of steps, if you will. But the end result doesn't depend on the gene. It depends on the expression of the gene. So going around and measuring which genes we have and what have you, which is now the genetics industry, to me doesn't make a lot of sense. Because it's not the question of whether we do or don't have some genes we wish we didn't have. It's more a question of just eating the right food. Eat the right food, nature takes care of it, but just keep it under control for the most part. Keep it under control, those genes, as they get expressed to do whatever they do. It enhances the good genes doing the right thing. It represses the genes that don't do so, that don't do exactly the right thing. So what is it? Is it genes or nutrition that cause disease? That's the question you see in one form or another from time to time that gets in the public press. We worked on this some now 35, as I say, 40 years ago as well. This is before the DNA, before the Human Genome Project, long before that. But we had ways of considering this question. I'm going to show you this little schematic here what I mean by this. Starting at the top, there are some normal cells, that's what this intended to mean. And on your left are some cells that got some red ones there. That's where we plant some cancer seeds. In other words, on that particular side of the equation, you got some cells that are sprinkled with some cancer seeds. And now the first mutation has occurred. On the right side, you got much less. Now, if you, from that point onwards, if the nutrition were the same, obviously the cells on the left, the tissues on the left that get the most seeds planted, cancer seeds, but they're going to get more cancer. That makes sense, right? More tumors. However, we did this. We did it in a way in which, even though, let's say, a group of cells has more mutations there, headed destined to get more cancer, in reality, if we then just simply gave them low-protein diets, they didn't get the cancer. In contrast, the ones that had just a little bit of seeds planted, if you give them a higher-protein diet, you turn it on. So what's controlling here? Everything starts with the gene, admittedly, but the ability of the genes to actually cause the end result, the cancer, is controlled by nutrition. So nutrition is, far more important, essentially, than the genes. Nutrition controls genes. Here's another example of that. If you look at the relationship, and this is something that was published in the 1960s, the 70s, and 80s, if you compare the intake of total fat, I'm going to say animal protein as well, with respect to breast cancer, we see in different countries this really impressive relationship. The higher the fat intake, the higher the breast cancer rate. See that nice straight line? That led mischievously to everybody assuming that fat was the answer to everything. Just cut down fat and you'd be safe and you'd be home. It's not the answer. This was really should have been expressed as the consumption of animal protein. But in any case, we saw this sort of relationship. Those countries that consume most fat and most animal food had the most breast cancer. Then some studies were organized in a number of instances looking at people who maybe were born in a country where there's not much cancer. And they moved to a country where the diet changes, and they get the cancer. Japanese moving to the United States, here in California especially, was a classic case. So the Japanese on the typical Japanese diet, low fat, low protein, low animal foods, less cancer, move here, all of a sudden cancer starts to come in. Heart disease, colon cancer, breast cancer, and what have you. So again, the genes aren't being changed. What caused this appearance of cancer was nutrition. It wasn't genes. So the whole argument then, therefore, about genes being so important, we need to know each of us as individuals, I'm going to say that's misplaced. It's simply just on the wrong track. Billions of dollars are being spent to promote the idea that if we could just understand which genes do what, we could have a great future. Not true. I don't agree with that at all. So nutrition controls genetic expression. Now, I want to turn to now your attention. So I'm just throwing out some examples here where we've taken the wrong track. In the end, when you put it all together, you come out with something that I think is really robust. I want to speak now just about what do we think by nutrition. As I said, we sorted out some things there maybe. The genes, that nutrients work together and a lot of chemicals that we don't call nutrients, but they are involved. And so they work together and they involve multiple mechanisms and so forth and so on. That's one side of the argument about what nutrition is. When we actually think of it, though, in the context of, eating food, we get hungry. We eat food. We all want to eat food, obviously. And what drives us to eat food, especially when you're really hungry or you're in a situation you don't have access to all the right food? Our desire for food is mainly driven at a fundamental level at least, by the need for getting enough calories or energy, same thing. We want to have enough calories. That's really fundamental, very basic stuff. At the same time, we also tend to think, at least in the Western societies, that we want to eat the food that has the most protein, right? I mean, protein has been emphasized for 150 years, and so the more protein we get, you know, the better off we're going to feel about things. So that's the sort of the basic assumption. Now, let's look at that question a little more carefully. But in order to do so, I want to go back and tell you, too, go back to our rat studies. We turned on the cancer by using this protein from cow's milk. And other animal proteins have a similar kind of effect that way. But we tested two plant proteins to see if they did the same thing. And it turned out soy and wheat protein did not increase cancer development, even when it was fed at 20% level. So remember that thing I showed you before, the protein turns it on? It's an animal protein thing. Specifically in that particular example, it was casein turning, the cow's milk protein turning on the cancer. And, of course, the soy and wheat protein, even when it was fed at 20% level, didn't have any effect. That's kind of interesting. So, in fact, that we did that many years ago and kind of caught my attention. You know, there's something different between animal proteins and plant proteins. Animal proteins tend to cause these problems. Plant proteins don't. Okay, so let's move on. And sort of emerging from that is a statement I know is pretty provocative. I like to say it just to get people to think, because it's true. For one thing, casein is the most relevant chemical carcinogen ever identified. It's not these odd chemicals in food we hear about from time to time that make headlines. It's casein. Now, I don't want you to take that message home and just focus on that one point at all, because I'm really talking about the way in which it's actually, the way we actually determine what's carcinogenic and what's not. With the whole program having to do with finding what chemicals cause cancer and which ones don't is also misplaced, because they don't consider nutrition. So now let's go back, look at another aspect of nutrition I think is really important, very practical. In our animal studies, for example, we didn't feed just 5% or 20% protein. We fed, as you can see, 4, 6, 8, 10% different groups. All these animals had, you know, they had the first mutation, so they could get cancer, but they didn't. So up to 10% protein, no cancer. Then when we went in the excess of the 10%, that's where we got to cancer. So the protein effect occurs when it's being consumed at levels higher than what we need. That's the bottom line. When it's consumed at higher levels than what we need. Protein is essential. We need protein. That's not the question. It's just a question of how much, what kind. So I took this sort of shape, this curve here, and found that it actually tends to describe the human condition for other kinds of diseases, heart disease, a whole bunch of different diseases, quite frankly, and I'll come to that to the end. Incidentally, we humans consume protein levels up there in the danger zone. 95% of us are consuming more protein than we need. So we're putting ourselves at some risk for not just cancer, heart disease, and a bunch of other things. So I took that same shape curve, right, and I made it just for a generic kind of thing, relating disease risk on the y-axis with different levels of protein, go from 4 to 20. That's more or less the range that we would want to think about, because that's where we're consuming things. So what do we know about that shape of that curve? It's really kind of interesting. The minimum amount of protein in this case that we need, and this has been determined for 75 to 100 years, and it stood the test of time. The minimum amount of protein we need is more around 4, 5, 6% of total energy. So a diet that has 4 to 5, 6% protein is where that's what we really need to meet the losses we otherwise incur. So we need that much. But what was done with the early researchers who actually did this study, or these studies, and subsequently, they didn't want to tell the public, oh, you only need 4, 5, 6% protein because that's this experimental setting. Let's be safe. So they jacked it up a couple of standard deviations. That gave rise to the recommended dietary or recommended daily intake, formerly known as the recommended dietary allowance, the RDA. So the RDA for protein is around 9, 10%. Fair enough. In fact, that level of of protein around 5, 9, 10% is really almost ideal. It's almost ideal, really. And we don't need to go above that. Unfortunately, over time, because of the bias we've had, we've always assumed that we need diets having at least 10% protein. That's the minimum. That's not the minimum. The minimum is around 5-6%. So anyhow, that's why we keep thinking all the time we get more protein. So anyhow, there's the RDA, recommended dietary allowance. Now we're just meeting all of our protein needs. We're not having the problems like increasing blood cholesterol and increasing cancer growth and all that. The average protein consumption in our diet is around 17 to 18%. So what have we done? We've worshipped protein so much. And everybody's telling us to get all the protein we can get. We need to consume the food that has the most protein, the best quality protein. And that, for almost everyone, meant eating meat, eating animal foods. Meat is not the only source of protein. We get all the protein we need from plant material. That's a really important point. So we ended up, as a society, consuming high-protein diets. And the average of the total protein we consume, about 70 to 80% of that protein is from animal foods. So we're basically a carnivorous society for the most part. We're really enriching our diets with lots and lots of animal food. So what happens there? Now, you know, and if you go back to all those mechanisms, all those nutrients and stuff like that, we have to worry a little about all that protein, especially if it's animal-based, causing all this, these kind of problems. That's problem number one. I call that the direct effects of protein, and they're almost endless. Here's what really happens in reality. If you consume a whole food plant-based diet, vegetables, fruits, grains, so forth, the average, you'll easily meet, every case, you'll meet the minimum needs for protein. Plant foods provide all the protein we need. In fact, it provides the ideal levels of protein. But you know, as I said, we don't do that. We stick in there some meat and eggs and milk because we think we have to have more protein. And we think that mainly comes from these kind of foods. So now we're up to 20% in this model here, if you will, a bunch of which is the animal food. But this is not just an additive thing. Here's what really happens. When we do that, let's say we wanted to move from wherever it was, we wanted to get up around 16% protein total. So we put in some animal food. What we do, as we put in animal food in the diet and contributing calories, is filling us up with calories, we're displacing the foods we ought to be eating. We're displacing the vegetables and the fruits and the grains. So first thing you know, 70% of our total protein on average is some animal foods. So we've got two things going on here. First off, the animal protein itself is causing us problems. We have lots of evidence for that. Second thing, and this is equally important, maybe more so, it's hard to know. The second thing that's happening, looks like a protein effect, but what second thing is happening, we're displacing the foods that matter, the vegetables and fruits and grains. That's a big deal. So you got both of those things going on, the direct effects of protein and the indirect effects caused by. Let's look at the difference between animal and plant foods. Here's five groups of nutrients, antioxidants, complex carbohydrates, vitamins, fat, protein. And I'm characterizing them as to where they come from. You can see from plants and animals, basically. Antioxidants really only made in plants. And if there's one group of nutrients that's the most important, I'm going to argue it's antioxidants. That's really significant. Antioxidants repress aging. Antioxidants repress cancer. Antioxidants repress heart disease. We know all the bit parts of that story. Antioxidants are critical, only made in plants. So when we're consuming more animal food, what are we doing? We're decreasing the consumption of these really important nutrients. Complex carbohydrates are great, beautiful, when they're natural form. I'm not talking about sugar. I'm not talking about white flour. I'm talking about the natural source of carbohydrate. So plants, complex carbohydrates are only made in plants. Yeah, there's a little bit of glycogen, and for those of you who may be in this business, you know, made in the liver of us animals, but that doesn't count. The carbohydrates that we consume only come from plants. So when we eat food, what we should be thinking about, if we're being rational, let's eat those foods that got the most antioxidants. Let's eat those foods that have the most complex carbohydrates. Turns out to be the same food, of course. Also, the vitamins, in a classical definition, are all made in plants. I know we got vitamin D and we got vitamin this and vitamin that. Vitamin B12 is microbiological. Vitamin D is the correct form of vitamin D is really made in animals. And even vitamin A, for those who may be familiar with this story, is not a vitamin. I don't consider vitamin D and vitamin A to be vitamins because there's something else. And vitamin A is a metabolite, vitamin D is a hormone, and it should be treated like that. In any case, the critical vitamins that really matter are basically made in plants. So here we got these plants, and over here you can see in the animal side of the equation, they don't have this good stuff. Both plants and animals have fat and protein, but animals have more protein, more fat than we need. So when we start eating animal foods, we're asking for trouble on multiple fronts, on countless, countless fronts. Processed foods is a mixed bag of crap. Processed foods, you know, it was whatever the manufacturers can put together to satisfy their hedonistic desire for sweet things and salty things and fatty things. We become addicted to salt, sugar, and fat. So they mix all this stuff together, even if they're using plant parts. You know, take a little sugar from plants, take some white flour from plants, take some of that good oil out of plants, for the most part, put it all together, mix it in a bowl, cook it, we got our donut. So, you know, that's plant-based. That's not what I'm talking about, of course. So in reality, the plant foods are really where it's at. That's why I like to say whole food, plant-based is a positive message. It works. I don't like to say, particularly like to say, don't eat any animal foods. I tend to drift in that direction. But it's better to keep the message positive and say, because the plants have so much value. And the closer we get to a whole food plant-based diet, the healthier we're going to be. So let's summarize here. Our nutrition thinking generally assumed to be derived from animal-based food. Somehow we got that in our brain. The animal foods are best. They're the most nutrient-dense. It's the best quality in the case of protein, this and that. No, it's not. That's the worst kind. And there's so many different studies showing that now. When you look at the data in this fashion. And the hazards of animal-based protein diets both due to the direct effects of protein as well as the indirect effects, as I've already said. This question is, I would suggest, the whole food industry. So I've ended up questioning the cancer industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the food industry. What's left? I mean, the science that is found that these industries are founded on is flawed, is really seriously flawed in terms of human health. So now there's one couple more things to add to this story. One thing is whole fat plant-based foods, and this comes from a various and sundry kinds of data that we analyzed, and some of which we did, that was published in our book, The China Study. And the whole food plant-based diet thing, in terms of the literature that's published, has a really broad range of effects. You know, it prevents cancer. It can be used to actually reverse cancer, at least experimentally. Heart disease can be wiped out. My good friend, Dr. Caldwell Essett, has made that story famous, as has Dr. Ornish. Dr. Ornish and Dr. Essett, and those two, have done some really brilliant work working with people curing heart disease. Okay, it really works. Using basically the same thing. But in cancer, I think I'm convinced also it has a lot of effect there. We haven't done enough to really prove the point because the cancer oncologists don't want to hear this story. So it's an uphill battle. But in any case, when I wrote the China study with my youngest son, we went into the literature to see maybe some of this old literature had some stories here. We just ignored it over time. So I found this stuff here. And some of this I already knew, but I found some additional things. And here's just a list of a bunch of different diseases. Look at some of these. Some of them are serious. Some of them are more, nuisance kinds. All these diseases can be prevented for the most part, and in many cases can be reversed from the evidence we now have by consuming a whole food plant-based diet. I mean, that's a pretty good collection. And there's still quite a bit more. This is just some of them. These are the ones that said actually peer-reviewed papers. So what this plant food, what the nutritional effect is so exciting, is the whole food plant-based diet in terms of its nutrient has a very broad effect. It means lots and lots of different illnesses and problems we have. It also creates health. It makes us more athletic too, by the way. I'm familiar with some, got to know some world-class athletes who now try this and really get, are getting some really extremely exciting results when they do that. This thing is fast. If you are living on the typical Western diet and you go over here and you start eating this stuff that we're talking about, this rabbit food, you go over there like that, at first you may not like it so much because you're addicted to fat, sugar, and salt. I know because I came from there. We're addicted. And so then you have to give yourself a little time. But when you do that, and if you do the whole thing, if you've got a problem, your problems tend to dissipate really quickly. Whole variety of problems. That's really what it comes down to. So we have these studies now going on, not published, unfortunately, very much, by various people, you know, doing the so-called intervention studies. Take a group of people, give them this food, see what happens. That was shown, I think, to some extent in Forks Over Knives, the film that you may have seen. You saw some examples, especially of Dr. Esselstyn's patients. Now, if the dietary effect is sustained, that's what we'd like to have. This is not a sort of pill and procedure thing. You don't take the diet today to get rid of your aches and pains and then go back to what you were doing before. No, it's not that. You have to actually change, think it, act it, believe it, and sustain it. That's when you get the real good effects that will then stay with you in the course of time. So this idea of the whole food plant-based diet is not just about preventing future diseases. It's not about preventive medicine, which we've used that word a lot over the years. This is about treatment. Treatment, what? That's the domain of medicine. Right now we use pills and procedures to treat disease, right? I'm saying, hey, just take this here. Use this as a means of, as the first approximation. I'm not saying there aren't cases for the need for drugs, obviously, when it's really desperately really needed. But the first approximation, the first approach should say, try this, see what happens. Okay, now I'm going to finish up real quickly within this time frame. Here's where it becomes kind of significant. Don't focus on these numbers too much. I'm just saying, if we made a conservative estimate of the amount of diseases that could be prevented by people doing this, you get a very different equation of what are the chief causes of disease. Let's say we could prevent two-thirds of all heart diseases. That's conservative. It's closer to 100%. Two-thirds of cancers, two-thirds of strokes and diabetes, three-fourths of that. There's the numbers of the estimate of the number of people whose lives each year would be saved. So just nutrition alone, if we did it right, we could save at least over 1 million lives. We just did it right. That's the kind of numbers we're talking about here. This is a big effect. So now let's put this in the, okay, this is the half the equation. I say, you know, if you listen to CDC, the number one cause of death is heart disease, right? I always say that heart disease. You know, opportunities for stents and statins and all kinds of procedures. Heart disease, then cancer, and on down the list. The CDC knows this, but they won't say it. The number one cause of death is nutrition ignorance. And we don't teach it. We don't do research on it the way it should be done. So I'm going to say that our number one cause of death in this country is malnutrition. Just being really dumb about it, really being ignorant about it. And so if we just put that on our plate and thought about it, we could solve huge problems. So here I've just listed the industries I just touched on. Each of these, I've been very superficial here, I think, in summarizing too quickly, but let me tell you, the fundamental science for these five industries is not, the science we're now using is not right. And I could easily make a case that each one of these industries need to be turned upside down. We have this term called disruptive technology. If I've ever heard of the concept of disruptive technology used, this is it. Especially when you put them all together. We have a system that involves medical practice. It involves our thoughts about the environment. It involves all kinds of industries that are spending billions of dollars on and just ignoring the one thing that matters. The one thing that matters far, far and away of everything else is just understanding nutrition. And the public is not being told. It's almost like a concerted effort on the part of authorities to deny this information to the public. So I'll finish up quickly. We have an online course I must tell you about. We're kind of excited about it. It's a nonprofit foundation that we've had now for five or six years. We've offered an online course in nutrition. We get 30 continuing medical education credits for doctors and the other continuing medical education credits for other professions. And actually, we partner with the arm of Cornell that does online courses. And they're offering something like 200 and some courses, and we're actually number one of the 200. So it's really been really unusually successful. If any of you might be interested in doing that, you can see the ad there. Oh, wait a minute, that's wrong. I showed this is an old slide. It's got my name there. It should be nutritionstudies.org, not my name. Nutritionstudies.org. I've got to change that. And then I'll just finish up here. We've got quite a family, thanks to my wife's support over the years, who are now involved in this. We've got some different books in case you might be interested. This is what Bill Grant mentioned in the beginning. We've got a new film out called Plant Purination. It'll be in theaters on July 4th. Our oldest son, Nelson, is doing that. There's the cookbook goes with it. It goes back there in the back. We've been actually screening this now, and tonight here in San Francisco is city number 21, I think it is, that we're going around the country showing that. It's more the question having to do with why haven't we heard this before? Force of an Eye is a fantastic, good film, sort of laying out here's the information more or less, but we wanted to go to the next step and then ask the question, why haven't we heard this before? And so our son Nelson is director of that film. A couple of books there that I think you know about. They're back there. I'm actually now working on a second edition of the China Study, hoping to have it out very soon. Tom and I should say. We're excited about that because we're being a little bit more rabble-rousing in this second edition if we haven't been already. Wait a minute. And then there's, some others. Our daughter has a cookbook. Our daughter-in-law has Plant Pure Nation up there as part of it. That book is back there. And then our son that did the co-authored the book with me, he's a physician now, and he's just published this Campbell Plan. He actually has been recruited to direct a new program in nutrition and medicine in a major medical school. It's the first of its kind in the country. So we're excited about that, sort of getting nutrition into medical schools. That's really key, I think. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Campbell. Now we have a few about 10, 12 minutes for questions. One question from the audience is, what is your typical daily menu, breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Well, my wife's sitting back there. I eat whatever she feeds me. No, breakfast, a lot of us in this business use oatmeal, quite frankly, without milk. Obviously, we don't use dairy. Oatmeal or some other kind of cereal, perhaps, a mixture of things. Fruits, obviously, salads and stuff for lunch, hot meal for dinner. It's just a whole bunch of different kinds of things. I can't even think of all of them. They're very tasty.
Okay. Of all the countries in the world, which countries have the diets that are most in harmony with your ideas?
Oh, wow. It's really hard to say. I mean, in some ways, I kind of have to break that down a little bit. I mean, places in the poor countries, because they're poor and they can't get access to the food they think they want. They're mostly eating plant-based foods. So in one sense, they're doing better, but they have other problems that compromise what they're eating. They've got public health problems and things, so you know, it's kind of hard to tease that out, as you, I'm sure, know so well. I don't know of a country. I thought Puerto Rico might be one, but it's not. It's probably worse than we are in the mainland. I don't know.
Okay. You mentioned the difference between casein and soy protein. Are all animal proteins bad and all plant proteins good, or is it what they're associated with? Or?
Right. Well, the only example of where a whole bunch of animal proteins were compared with a whole bunch of plant proteins, actually, was that of K.K. Carroll, a friend of mine, who compared the effect of all these proteins on its ability to increase plasma cholesterol levels. Protein does that, by the way. Animal protein increases blood cholesterol levels. Quite dramatic. And he did that, and all the animal foods segregated out. There's some difference between them, but all the animal foods tend to raise cholesterol levels and stimulate the formation of atherogenesis, we say, early heart disease. All the plant proteins were down here. But they're total segregation in that experiment. In other words, about 20 of each, there was no overlap. Now, we haven't done that with cancer. We can only look at that question in a sense, to some extent, epidemiologically, but that's poor. It's very difficult. But I'm going to suggest, because of the biochemistry, that all the animal proteins are going to behave rather like each other, certainly far better than plant proteins in terms of their benefits. I mean, plant benefits for plant proteins, yes.
Okay. Here's a question. If you have osteoporosis, how do you get calcium on a plant-based diet?
Well, there's enough calcium in plant-based diets to put more than enough. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the fracture rate, bone fracture rate in different countries around the world, and I think, Bill, you had something published in this yourself, or if I'm not mistaken, summarized, the higher the consumption of calcium, the higher the consumption of animal protein, the higher the rates of osteoporosis. The higher the consumption of dairy, the greater is the risk for osteoporosis. Exactly the opposite of what the dairy industry has been telling us.
Right. What about people with diabetes? They have to avoid sugars, of course, but animal products also make an impact on diabetes.
Yes, it does. And the diabetes, as you may know, 90% or so of all the diabetes is type 2. We used to call it adult onset, although that's creeping into children. But in any case, 90% is type 2. You lost your ability, gradually lost your ability to produce insulin, and then in turn you have this so-called insulin-resistant syndrome that piles on top of it. So type 2 diabetes can be resolved within days. Dr. McDougall, John McDougall, here in this area, is one of the first that I heard of his really results on that point, the way he could actually turn people around on diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, that's the people who are compromised. They can't even produce insulin, so they have to be on medication for the rest of their life. But as we have done some, my son has done some of this, as we've done some of these immersion programs, intervention programs, we have run into some type 2s whose the amount of medicine they need actually drops quickly. So even type 1s, for whatever reason, are regaining considerable health when they go on this.
Wow. Okay.
They're still going to probably have to take their medications, but some, but not nearly as much.
Here's a question. It's a local question, but I think it has broader implications. The San Francisco Senior Lunch Program has recently eliminated the vegetarian portion and will not provide a vegan option. How do we change this?
Well, first off, I have to say, you know, I don't use the word vegan or vegetarian. I know those communities are very big supporters of what I talk about, and I appreciate very much their motivation for doing what they do on an individual level. I mean, the vegans, for example, I have to, this is a diversion a bit, but I have to say it. The people who have become vegans over the years, as you may know, and maybe a number of you hear that, became vegans primarily for ethical reasons, really, without paying a lot of attention to the science. And so as a result, the typical vegan diet, unfortunately, still contains a lot of sugar and white flour and too much fat. A big study recently showed that the average fat content of the vegan diet is 30%. That's not a whole lot different from everybody else. So the vegan diet is not, I would argue, is what it should be. So that's why I like to say whole food, plant-based. 90% of the vegetarians, by the way, are still consuming dairy. And if there's one food to get out of the diet, it should be dairy. That's the first one that needs to go. And so vegetarians and vegans don't do things quite right. They have good motivations for what they do. They're very good supporters. But we need to think beyond that. And to get it into schools, I think we need to focus a little bit more on the science of teaching, you know, what this kind of food can do. I think the vegan word tends to turn off, I know it does, tends to turn off people that we're trying to convince. Because if I walk up to somebody and say, I'm a vegan, I think you should have vegan. Well, everybody assumes somehow I'm taken a superior ethical position. And if I walked up to somebody and say, you know, I'm a vegan, I'm doing this, I'm ethical. What does that mean? They're unethical? No, it doesn't work that way. So I suggest we get back to the science, correct the language a little bit, and do it that way, even with the children in schools. Show them the science, let them experience it, learn how to cook it. Yeah.
What about some of the adverse components of plants, phytic acid, gluten, things like that?
Well, the gluten thing, I'm not that familiar with it. I don't really want to claim any particular knowledge on it, so I'm borrowing it to some extent from my friends in the literature. But you know, gluten sensitivities can be a serious problem for people. That is known. I think it's fairly well confirmed now. It can be really quite a problem. The question there, and there are various outcomes that associate with that and related problems with grain, pretty much. You know, the irritable bowel syndrome, colitis, you know, these kinds of things that occur, largely related in some way, one way or another, very complicated, to the consumption of certain grains, especially wheat. And I buy into the idea that that can be a problem, obviously for some folks, and a very serious problem for some people. But I don't agree that, as suggested by some, that 30% of the people in this country have to be worried about gluten problems. It's more like 3 to 4%. My son Tom just wrote a chapter on that, or a big section on that, reviewing the literature quite critically, I think, and has a pretty good case to make that the number of gluten-sensitive people is much lower than what we've been led to believe. But it's important. It's important. People have to be conscious of it, and if they see it, then deal with it. Avoid wheat, if you will, maybe some others.
Okay. Are there some rules of thumb of how much protein is in, say, like green vegetables and grains and rice and beans and so on?
Well, the protein is surprising. You know, I said 10%. You know, you saw that up to 10% is pretty good, and then going higher. It turns out that, you know, consuming an all-food plant-based diet, if you're consuming a lot of beans, rich source of protein, if you're consuming whole grains, also a good source of protein, if you're doing that, the average protein content in a diet like that can be as high as 17-18%. No problems over that one, because when you're doing that and you're using whole food, you're getting all the other antioxidants that come along with it. It's a total package, so it's not a problem. But you can easily get to 10%, as I said before, just have an average. That's all the protein we need. And so it can range higher, you know, in those kind of diets. And but it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question about our dogs and cats. Are they being fed the wrong food, and is that causing them cancer and other problems?
Well, you know, I always thought that dogs are carnivores. I guess they are. Certain cats. But when I was teaching at Cornell, the first time I was teaching a course like this, we have on our campus this rule that across the campus for years, dogs can come into the classroom. It was a will, a state that was left to the university, and that was what we had to do. So dogs are in there. And there was one dog in particular, a beautiful dog, that was coming to class every day with the other students. And that dog had the sleekest hair coat and was really kind of neat looking. And then since I've learned and seen, it's just all anecdotal, that the animals do, especially dogs, they now they have vegan food for dogs. And I would have never guessed it. But it turns out that they seem to respond well. Cats are a little different. You know, cats do have to have some meat, that's for sure.
Okay, I have just time for one more question. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of food and nutrition in the United States and the world?
You know, I'm optimistic in part because of the situation with medical schools. The majority of my talks in the last 3 or 4 years have been to medical schools, grand rounds and things like that. And in the beginning, that wasn't the case. But now I'm really very much involved in speaking to medical schools, medical faculties. And there are people in the field of medicine, really good people, obviously. They just, and at first it was kind of silence when I talked and said these things, like, you know, are you serious? Kind of thing. Now what I'm finding is a lot of people in medicine are saying, tell me about it. They try it with their patients, they begin to change. So I think that's my optimism is derived from that in part. The medical, and I see medical doctors being the ones that's going to have to take the lead in the future for this information. They went to school to treat people. They just weren't given the right information. Now they're getting the right information, and that can't stop.
All right. Thanks to Dr. Campbell for his talk here today. And this concludes the talk of the 113th year of the Commonwealth Club of California.